given at the start of each day's exercise. 25 minutes later, the first effects of the drug became apparent. The men began to relax and to giggle. But this man was more seriously affected and had to be removed from the exercise. After 35 minutes, one of the radio operators had become incapable of using his set, and the efficiency of the rocket launcher team was also very impaired. Ten minutes later, the attacking section had lost all sense of urgency. Notice the bunching and indecision as they enter a wood occupied by the enemy. Almost immediately, the section commander tried to use a map to find the location of troop headquarters, and the prisoner's escort had to have the way pointed out to him, although it was in plain sight, 700 yards away over open country. Minutes after taking the drug, radio communication had become difficult, if not impossible. Still capable of sustained physical effort. However, constructive action was still attempted by those retaining a sense of responsibility in spite of physical symptoms. But 1 hour and 10 minutes after taking the drug, with one man climbing a tree to feed the birds, the troop commander gave up, admitting that he could no longer control himself or his men.
During this Seattle 1999 WTO protests, participants often referred to the Teamsters and Turtles Coalition. Labor activist and retired Evergreen State College professor Dan Leahy explains what people meant when referring to Teamsters and Turtles.
Workers from unions, environmentalists, came together and decided we need a new plant. We need a new way of organizing our economy that is beneficial to both the worker and to our environment. That's what it meant. In other words, that Teamsters and Turtles really reflected the possibility of this new political power where people that knew the insides of a plant and people knew the effects of that plant outside in the community came together with new strategies and tactics. And
today marks the 10-year anniversary of the protest in Seattle that took place during the World Trade Organization's meeting. The week brought together a coalition of environmentalists, labor activists, and human rights groups, and drew attention to the WTO's growing influence throughout the world. It also led to a new alternative gathering of activists called the World Social Forum, and then the U.S. Social Forum. In the first of a two-part series, FSRN's Jill Friedberg has more on the legacy of the protests 10 years later.
After the WTO protests in Seattle, grassroots organizations and social movements from around the world began meeting to build alliances under the World Social Forum. Michael Guerrero, coordinator of the Grassroots Global Justice Alliance, describes the impact it had on community organizations in the U.S.
After the battle in Seattle, and there was a series of large-scale mobilizations against the World Bank, the IMF, and WTO, the organizers in these protests said it's not enough for us to protest. We need to figure out what then is the vision, the alternative vision that we're putting forward. And so they came up with the idea of a social forum as a counter to the World Economic Forum that convenes every year. The first one was held in Brazil, attended by 15,000, and then it just started to grow exponentially. And we were just really excited by what we saw in terms of national movements and international movements. And it just led us to question, well, what is it that we're not doing in the U.S. to build strong national movements like this? We need a strong national movement here in the United States.
Tammy Bang Liu was arrested in the streets of Seattle in 1999 and is now senior organizer and co-coordinator of the Labor Community Strategy Center in Los Angeles. They refer to themselves as a grassroots think tank and act tank. One of the weaknesses of the current is that we're functioning in silos of healthcare, of workers' rights, of housing, of environmental justice, and not necessarily seeing those as a connected struggle. According to Michael Guerrero, these divisions between social movements within the U.S. prompted the development of the U.S. Social Forum. But the organizers wanted the U.S. Social Forum organizing process to be substantially different from that of the World Social Forum.
There was a noticeable absence of people of color in the WTO protests in 1999. We saw that same dynamic at the World Social Forum. We felt that the U.S. Social Forum then had to have a different character. When we started the organizing process of the USSF, it was a fundamental principle that people of color and indigenous groups and grassroots organizations that were based in those communities really had to be at the center of organizing that process.
Yes, it's been 10 years since the infamous Battle of Seattle. On November 30th, 1999, tens of thousands of activists from across the country and around the world prevented delegates from attending the global trade talks by forming a human chain around the Seattle Convention Center and shutting down the city's downtown. Police responded by firing tear gas and rubber bullets into the mostly peaceful crowd. The protest resulted in 600 arrests and in the eventual collapse of the talks, as well as the resignation of Seattle's police chief. It was a watershed moment for the movement against corporate globalization, and Democracy Now! Was there, broadcasting live.
Today, on this 10th anniversary of the historic protests in Seattle, we're joined by three guests on the phone. Norm Stamper, yes, the former police chief of Seattle and author of Breaking Rank, a top cop's expose of the dark side of American policing. We're also joined by longtime activist David Solnit. He's joining us from San Francisco, though he was in Seattle. He was one of the Direct Action Network organizers in Seattle 10 years ago and co-author with his sister Rebecca Solnit of the Battle of Seattle, published by AK Press, out this week. Also, Anand Natan joins us, the North America coordinator for the Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives. He led a group of 4,000 Canadian workers to the protests in Seattle in 1999. Both David Solnit and Anand Natan are part of the Mobilization for Climate Justice Coalition that's organizing demonstrations and civil disobedience in 9 cities across the country today on this 10th anniversary. We welcome you all. David Solnit, let's begin with you. Describe 10 years ago.
10 years ago was amazing. We had several thousand people organized through the Direct Action Network who decided to shut down what we consider the most undemocratic institution on the planet, the WTO. Marching out 7 a.m. pre-dawn, setting up blockades around the city. And what was amazing is that within a few hours, the people of Seattle spontaneously joined us, so that very soon you were linking arms, keeping delegates out of the WTO and shutting it down with people who had never been involved in any organization before, and then backed up by the People's Assembly, by organized labor, breaking through the AFL security folks and joining us. And so by the end of the afternoon, by midday, they had to cancel activities. And then the sad part was the Seattle police, by 10 a.m., opened fire with chemical weapons, tear gas, concussion grenades, armored vehicles. But people held tight, shutting it down from dawn to dusk. And at the same time, there were actions across the planet. The longshore workers had shut down every port up and down the West Coast.
And David Solnit, I remember very well, as if it was yesterday, being both out in the streets covering your protests and with Democracy Now!, with the New York Daily News, but then going back inside to the convention center as the delegates didn't know what to do. They were totally stunned because they couldn't get enough people inside even to get a meeting together. And so
I think it's gonna be written about Seattle. The thing that's gonna be written about Seattle. new global economy, we lose our desire, our power, and our vision. In any part of the world, there are men and women who choose the path of least resistance, who accept lives in fear and isolation. We will respond to death with life. We will respond to the nightmare with the dream. We will fight and imagine.
In my view, corporate rule is dictatorship, and the denial of shaping an economy is an end of democracy.
Breaking through the AFL security folks and joining us. And so by the end of the afternoon, by midday, they had to cancel activities. And then the sad part was the Seattle police, by 10 a.m., opened fire with chemical weapons, tear gas, concussion grenades, armored vehicles. But people held tight, shutting it down from dawn to dusk. And at the same time, there are actions across the planet.
Alternative vision that was putting forward. And so they came up with the idea of a social forum as a counter to the World Economic Forum that convenes every year. The first one was held in Brazil, attended by 15,000, and then it just started to grow exponentially. And we were just really excited by what we saw in terms of national movements and international movements. And it just led us to question, well, what is it that we're not doing in the U.S. to build strong national movements like this? We need a strong national movement here in the United States. It's incumbent on us in terms of what our communities need, but the international community is really looking to us as well.
Tammy Bang Liu was arrested in the streets of Seattle in 1999 and is now senior organizer and co-coordinator of the Labor Community Strategy Center in Los Angeles. They refer to themselves as a grassroots think tank and act tank.
One of the weaknesses of the movement currently is that we're functioning in these silos of healthcare, of workers' rights, of housing, of environmental justice, and not necessarily seeing those as a connected struggle.
According to Michael Guerrero, these divisions between social movements within the U.S. prompted the development of the U.S. Social Forum. But the organizers wanted the U.S. Social Forum organizing process to be substantially different from that of the World Social Forum.
There was a noticeable absence of people of color in the WTO protest.
WCOM Radio, I'm Furious George. Thursday night, 10 years later after the Battle of Seattle, here we are. Micropowered community-based radio, many ways sponsored and inspired by all that good stuff that happened in Seattle in 1999. November 30th was the day that we actually shut down the World Trade Organization. Yours truly, Furious George, was there. And it's amazing. It's really been 10 years. It's unfortunately, can't really say that we've gone that much further as far as World Trade goes, but we did shut down the World Trade Organization, and it's definitely worth celebrating today. December 3rd was the day, I think the Friday after the meetings had started, where 10 years ago today we actually saw the meeting collapse. And I don't know. It's been a fun process to see all these other movements start up and compare them to what happened to WTO. We got some good music here in the studio. DJ 230 is here with us, playing there in the background some Miyagi. I've got, as always, some of this Two Fresh Beats I Just Can't Quit Playing, and some of that new Slugabed stuff I've got, plus some other stuff from Beat Dimensions, Flying Lotus, and others. This is Micropowered Community-Based Radio. Started off, Micropowered Radio in many ways is taking similar parallels, I think, to what happened with the global justice protests. Micropowered Radio, of course, started off as originally an illegal pirate radio experience, and then because we agitated and got what we needed, and believe it or not, I think it was 1999, we were able to get low-power FM radio established through the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, who eventually rejected some of the arguments from corporate radio about how micropowered radio was going to mess up the dial. Well, clearly here we are 10 years later as well, and not only are we seeing micropowered diverse radio spread across the country, but we're also seeing some really good attention to revolutionary insights and movements of all kinds. Unfortunately, they don't seem to be moving our commander-in-chief to take up positions that are more peaceful. We'll spotlight some of that absurdity tonight as well. I'm Furious. I do this every Thursday. You can check it out online, wcomfm.org, or go to furiousg.blogspot.com, where we'll post the show, and we have plenty of others, where we also post it on ainfosradio.net. So thanks for listening to Micropowered Community-Based Radio. I'm Furious. I'll be back.
that Pacific Lumber was cutting into the redwoods, and the Earth Firsters were trying to stop that. And they began to interact with each other and to share not only history and organizational strength, but also tactical advice. That alliance was an extremely potent combination. It was potent because it wasn't managed from Washington, D.C. It was highly creative, very powerful, and it wasn't something that was supported by either the national AFL-CIO, nor was it supported by national environmental organizations.
Another grassroots example of the alliance between labor and environmental organizations emerging after the World Trade Organization protests was the formation of the Alliance for Sustainable Jobs and the Environment, or ASJE. Dan Leahy headed ASJE from April 2003 until May 2004.
ASJE was another reflection of the desire to bring people together at the local level and let them see what new types of actions they would take to create a society in which the worker is respected, the environment is protected, and corporate greed is rejected.
We got everybody out here because this hurts people. This is bad for people. It's bad for our jobs here. It's bad for the people over there.
It's about their future being traded off by corporations who frankly don't give a shit what happens to them. That's what it's about. It's people are fed up with it. They understand it.
We are making available for you to leave now. There are protesters at the end of 6th Avenue on each end of our block, so you'd be let out right in the middle of the protest. I recommend you stay here if you can.
The opening session is still postponed. I called and asked for an immediate update.
Relax. Put your feet up. Go to your hotel room. Relax. Have lunch or until the situation is safer out there.
I would say
you cannot get to the Paramount. You cannot get to the Paramount.
Everyone knew you have to hold your hands and hold each other's hands, otherwise we're not going to make a difference. Each of us is too tiny. Each of us is only addressing a tiny piece of this giant problem. And until we join hands, we're not even going to start to begin to address it. But if we join hands, we can totally surround it. And that physically, literally, as well as symbolically, is what happened in Seattle.
We changed the landscape physically, but also mentally. Life is very restricted and boxed in. It's hard to break out and be free. So that was one of like the magnificent things about being in Seattle. That day, people didn't feel helpless. That was a moment to not be helpless.
Yesterday, being both out in the streets covering your protests and with Democracy Now, with the New York Daily News, but then going back inside to the convention center as the delegates didn't know what to do. They were totally stunned because they couldn't get enough people inside even to get a meeting together. And so it dragged on for hours and hours with many of the delegates just standing around trying to figure out what to do. The impact of the surprise of this on both the governments of many countries in the world as well as the organizers of the WTO. Can you talk about that?
Well, the action itself wasn't a surprise. It was very public that thousands of people were going to try and nonviolently shut down the World Trade Organization. I think what the surprise to the world was, and we're in a very similar moment this week in the lead up to Copenhagen, is that Americans broke ranks from their government and actually stood up for democracy, for human rights, and for the things we need in our lives. And that was the surprise.
Ananda Tan, talk about the organizing you did 10 years ago and the significance of the workers out on the streets in Seattle.
Well, Amy, 10 years ago was sort of a culmination of a decade of organizing for us in Western Canada. It was really a culmination of various movements recognizing that the corporate rule over our forests and our forest-dependent communities was really leading to disruption of community health and stability. And I work mainly with the forest worker organizing, and there's a few hundred of us who joined the Canadian Labour Congress and other trade unionists from around North America on the streets. And for us, it was really a first realization, or a wide realization, that our cause to prevent corporations from robbing our forests and our communities was linked to the fight of peasants from India and fisher folk around the world who are trying to protect their natural resources, peasants trying to protect their seeds. And so it was really a coming together of various movements. For us, coming down to Seattle, we came down with a slogan of fighting the Global Free Logging Agreement, which is what we call the Multilateral Agreement on Investments. That was a key component of the WTO. And we realized that our fight was linked to those of sort of communities, millions of people around the world. And perhaps my only regret is that we weren't able to sustain it back in on returning to Canada. But we did remain inspired by the fact that many of our allies around the world were eventually able to force the derailment of key things like the Agreement on Agriculture and really a lot of the major components of the Doha Round. So, as we move into this
10 years later, Ananda, as we move forward, the Copenhagen climate talks about to take place. How would you say the organizing from 10 years ago is translating into what's happening today?
Well, Amy, I think what we saw in Seattle was a combination of a broad dialogue in civil society. I was part of an alliance called the Labor Environmental Alliance, and it was the first time forest workers and environmental groups and indigenous activists got together to realize and recognize a common cause. With the climate crisis, I think we've learned from a lot of our lessons in various resource-based fights and come forward to realize that the fights of communities here in North America fighting climate-destructive and climate-polluting industries is linked to the fights of communities facing toxins in their backyards that are communities that are really being hit hard by the economic crisis here in North America. Their cause is linked to the cause of African farmers and Asian farmers who are running into serious limits to their productivity on their farms due to the climate crisis. And so we have a much bigger canvas. We have an opportunity to tackle the same corporations who were trying to liberalize international trade and their access to community resources around the world, and are now trying to do the same using this opportunity of the climate crisis to create markets for trading in carbon derivatives and using their existing control of energy resources to really to finance their development agenda in the third world. So I think we're at a place where once again we're faced with turning out massive numbers of people on the streets to challenge the corporate interference with international climate policy talks, but also here in the U.S., I think it's critical being in the country with the most amount of climate that's producing the most climate pollution, but also ostensibly owes the most amount of carbon reparations or climate debt to communities around the world for people to step out and start challenging these corporations that are housed here in this country, the major oil and gas companies and the banks that finance them.
Dynamic at the World Social Forum. We felt that the U.S. Social Forum then had to have a different character. When we started the organizing process of the USSF, it was a fundamental principle that people of color and indigenous groups and grassroots organizations that were based in those communities really had to be at the center of organizing that process. You know, it was based on an analysis of how is change actually going to take place in the United States. And for us, it has to be based in those communities that are being the most affected by these policies, and has to be.
forge a lasting friendship in which America is your partner and never your patron.
But that's not how some Afghan civilians view the troop buildup. Here's an excerpt of some voices from Afghanistan, courtesy of Brave New Foundation's Rethink Afghanistan project.
Stop this war. And if they really want to help our people, we don't need more soldiers.
We want calmness so that people are at peace and security, brother. Do you understand? The Americans came to keep peace for us. Is this called peace to drop bombs on people's homes? Is this called peace to kill their innocent children? Is this called peace to leave people weeping and mourning?
We have war since 30 years. Afghan ordinary people say it is enough.
I would like him to reconsider his policies towards Afghanistan, stop thinking militarization of the whole process in the country.
I'd like to say to him, listen to the Afghan people.
A sampling of Afghan voices opposed to the escalation back in the United States as protests are planned in cities across the country today. I'm joined now from Washington, D.C. by Ohio Congressman Dennis Kucinich. He opposes the troop buildup in Afghanistan. Welcome to Democracy Now! Congressmember Kucinich represents the Cleveland area. Your response to President Obama's West Point address.
First, I'd like to respond to the voices of the Afghan people. It's very clear they don't want to be saved by us. They want to be saved from us. And President Obama's escalation of the war, sending an additional 30,000 troops, will bring, as you pointed out, the total strength to about 100,000. That's $100 billion a year. That doesn't even include the private contractors we'll be paying for, which adds it to about $160 billion a year. It really begs the question about whether the nation building that we seek to do in Afghanistan would be better directed to rebuilding America, to creating jobs here, to rebuilding bridges here instead of blowing them up in Afghanistan. I think our priorities are misplaced, and I think that all those who really support this president, who really like him, and I like him, need to challenge him on this, because we can't just let this go by the boards because we may have some sympathetic feelings for the difficult task that he's undertaken.
Yeah, we're at a crucial moment where the political system is serving very well what we might call the warfare state. And we're in a part of the spin cycle for war where the messages come out conflating the policy of the president with supporting the troops. So we have these sort of preposterous yet accepted media messages from people such as Nancy Pelosi and others in Congress that even though they say they oppose the war and want it to end, they refuse to stop paying for it. They refuse to stop funneling billions every week from the U.S. Treasury to subsidize the slaughter, the sending and the deployment and the maintenance of U.S. troops and armaments to kill and be killed. And the message is that, well, we've got our military forces in the field, so we can't stop paying for them. Well, that's a perpetual argument for more war and against withdrawal from a war based on absolute deception.
President of the United States.
Congressman Kucinich, can you talk about the level of opposition in Congress right now and explain what Congressman Obie has been talking about, the war tax?
Well, first of all, we have to, it'll remain to be seen what the level of opposition is in the Congress, and I want to point out why. On October 8, 2009, the Congress of the United States passed a bill that authorizes the expenditure of $130 billion for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The House actually preceded the president in making a statement about support for the war.
If this little nation goes down the drain and can't maintain our independence, ask yourself what's going to happen to all the other little nations.
It would not bring peace. It would bring more war.
And many propaganda lines become stock and trade of those who started the war in the first place.
The party of FDR and the party of Harry Truman
party of cut and run.
The American people will not stand for surrender.
Cowards cut and run.
They're advocating a policy called cut and run.
That party's old pattern of cutting and running.
If we hightailed it, cut and run.
We won't cut and run.
Cut and run.
Cut and run.
We will not cut and run.
Cut and run.
Cut and run.
Cut and run.
How do you respond?
We'll stay the course.
We must stay the course.
We stay the course.
We will stay the course.
Start a war, and these arguments kick in that you can't stop it. So it's a real incentive for a president to lie, to deceive, to manipulate sufficiently to get the war started. And then they've got a long way to go without any sort of substantive challenge that says, hey, this war has to end.
Nixon said the enemy cannot defeat or humiliate the United States. Only Americans, he said, can do that.
The peacemakers are out there on the field. The soldier and the statesman need and welcome the sincere and the responsible assistance of concerned Americans. But they need reason much more than they need emotion. They must have a practical solution and not a concoction of wishful thinking and false hopes, however well-intentioned and well-meaning they may be. It must be a solution that does not call for surrender or for cutting and running now. Those fantasies hold the nightmare
of World War III
and a much larger war tomorrow.
Americans that don't have any health care, 15 million Americans who are out of work, another 10 million Americans whose homes are threatened with foreclosure, people going bankrupt, business failures. All these things are happening in our country, and we're acting like a latter-day version of the Roman Empire, reaching for empire while inside we rot. We have to challenge this because our future as a nation is at stake. If we continue to militarize, we lose our civil liberties, we lose our capacity to meet our needs here at home. The Fed may have it, to help finance $13 trillion in bailouts for Wall Street. You know, we have money for Wall Street and money for war, but we don't have money for work. We have money for Wall Street and money for war, but we don't have money for health care. We have to start asking ourselves, why is it that war is a priority, but the basic needs of the people of this country are not? And how are we getting the money to pay for the war? We're borrowing it. We're going deeper into debt. We're mortgaging our future. We're creating conditions where we'll become less democratic because we can't meet the most essential needs of our people. This needs to be challenged, and it needs to be challenged in a forthright way. And it can be challenged without making President Obama the issue. The issue is the war. The issue is America's reach for empire. The issue is our inability to meet the needs of people here at home.
Thank you.
Rocco-powered radio. I'm furious. It's Thursday night. Head into the 11 o'clock hour. Stick around. DJ Smooth Jazz is here. And I want to say thanks to DJ 230 for spinning some of this stuff, including turning me on to this guy here in the background. Slugabed. Cool mix.
Check it out.
We'll be back next Thursday and pick another theme like we've done tonight, celebrating the 10th anniversary of the protests in the Seattle area against the World Trade Organization in 1999, where we shut down the world's global tyrannical corporate trading system all through nonviolent direct action, peaceful protest. We took a couple rubber bullets, some tear gas, but we're still here to say F you to the WTO. And also, F you going out to all those war makers out there, including the president. I have to admit, it's just incredibly disappointing with what's happening in Afghanistan. So everybody else out there who's feeling my pain, I'm sure this set will have relaxed you a little bit, knowing that there are folks like you thinking similarly. I'll be back next Thursday. I'll be just as furious. And thanks for listening to Micropowered Community-Based Radio, WCOM.
Hey, Gabby.
11 p.m.